Right now, the protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline at the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota last year found support across tribal and racial lines. And this year, the Keystone XL pipeline being revived by the Trump administration is being opposed by a group called the Cowboy Indian Alliance. Those are some of the latest examples of Native communities and white Americans finding common ground on environmental issues. Our next guest says that if those alliances share a sense of purpose and respect cultural differences, they can lead to real change. Zoltan Grossman is a professor of geography and Native studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. He's the author of the new book, Unlikely Alliances, Native Nations and White Communities Joined to Defend Rural Lands. He's a graduate of UW-Madison, previously taught at UW-Eau Claire. Zoltan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
There's a long history, of course, of conflict between white Americans and Native Americans. You found significant moments of cooperation. What's given rise to some of these alliances around environmental issues over the last four decades or so?
Well, since the 1970s, starting in the Northwest, the Northern Plains, then into the Great Lakes, we've seen this pattern that some of the areas that went through some of the most intense conflicts over treaty rights, such as the spearfishing conflict in northern Wisconsin, ended up seeing some of the earliest and strongest alliances to protect the same natural resources that tribes and their rural white neighbors, such as farmers, ranchers, fishers, were fighting over. And I was involved in some of the work against metallic sulfide mines in northern Wisconsin. I was just fascinated by this and seeing some of the same patterns in places like South Dakota and Montana and here in Washington State. And it's really encouraging that oftentimes we hear that identity politics or cultural identity is somehow counterposed or in contradiction to unity politics of bringing people together. But what I found both through firsthand experience and also through interviewing about 120 people is that they're not in contradiction and that Native rights, treaty rights, can in fact be protecting the environment and local rural economies, benefiting everyone, including their rural white neighbors.
I want to talk about that spearfishing story a little more. It was a huge thing, of course, here in Wisconsin, very heated, I think overtly racist protests in some cases against targeting Native Americans, Ojibwe residents of the area over fishing rights. But you write that some of the people on the opposite sides of that treaty rights debate, as you were just saying, became allies. How did they move from a really bitter confrontation into cooperation?
Well, keeping dialogue open and keeping a bridge open, some of the spearfishing treaty rights leaders, such as Walt Brissett, such as Tom Molson, actually were interested in building bridges to some of their rural white neighbors, even in the midst of the conflict. Walt Brissett from Red Cliff said that he felt he had more in common with the anti-Indian people than with the state of Wisconsin that was not protecting the fish. And so many of the followers of some of the anti-treaty organizations began realizing once mining companies started coming into the ceded territory of northern Wisconsin, that in fact the anti-treaty movement wasn't going to protect them, and they, in fact, that the treaties that they had been fighting were some of the most important tools to protect the fishery and the local tourism economy. And I found what was fascinating is some of the areas of the most intense conflict around spearfishing, around Lac du Flambeau, Mole Lake, it was easier to form an environmental alliance and was more successful than around Lac-Qui-Ta Ray, where the conflict was not as intense and where the Ladysmith mine ended up being built. So near Lac du Flambeau, the Lynn mine was prevented from being open, and of course near Mole Lake, the long struggle against the Crandon mine was successful in 2003.
It's interesting to think back to the debates in the 1980s. You kind of point out that people realized over time that they'd had a shared value on both sides of the debate all the time, the value of conservation and the joys of fresh water and fishing.
Yeah, and when you have a local economy based partly on tourism, that means it's also an economic argument. And so if you want to protect your environment, instead of arguing over the fishery, you come together to protect the fishery against some of these foreign mining companies. So you had people, sportsmen like Herb Bittner, who was actually chairman of the Lang Lake County Republican Party, who put anti-mining literature on the Republican Party table at the Lang Lake County Fair. You had George Rock. You had union members like Jerry Gunderson, Bob Schmitz, Debbie McNutt. You had students like Dana Chernus, Deanna Erickson. So these companies love to divide people not only racially between Native and white, but also pitting environmentalists against labor unions, northern rural residents against urban students. And try as they might, they couldn't divide Wisconsinites by either race, class, or by region. And so across the country, you have this stereotype of the mainstream, urban-based, largely white environmental movement that they're just a bunch of hippies and yuppies who don't care about rural jobs. But what you had in Wisconsin in particular was the development of a new kind of environmental movement that was rural-based on the front lines of local people, middle-class, working-class people, multiracial, multigenerational, and the companies do not know how to defeat that kind of a movement anywhere in the country.
We're talking to Zoltan Grossman, author of the book Unlikely Alliances, Native Nations and White Communities Join to Defend Rural Lands. And I think when people think of Native protest and environmental issues, the big story over the last few years has involved pipelines in North Dakota and many other states for that matter. How do you apply the lessons you took from here in Wisconsin and elsewhere to what we're seeing in the news today?
Well, South Dakota historically was also, like northern Wisconsin, always a very heavy area of conflict between Native peoples, Lakota, and some of the white ranchers. But when there was coal and uranium mining proposed in the Black Hills, a bombing range, they've tended to come together in local areas. So this is not necessarily something completely new. But when the Keystone XL pipeline was proposed, these people came together in a very powerful way in South Dakota and Nebraska, and they're now coming together again against that pipeline. I think maybe the pipeline companies learned their lessons in North Dakota, which is really a petro state that's so much more dependent on oil than any other state I looked at. And so they fast-tracked the Dakota Access Pipeline. They criminalized the opposition, militarized the situation, and put up roadblocks to pit some of the local white residents against the Native people. And so perhaps they're learning their lessons trying to reduce democracy so another cowboy Indian alliance couldn't develop. But now that the Keystone XL pipeline has been revived, the opposition is coming back together, and I think Trump faces an uphill struggle to get that pipeline through. In the Pacific Northwest, here in Washington and Oregon, there were 14 new oil and coal terminals proposed to bring the fossil fuels from the Bakken Basin in North Dakota or the Alberta Tar Sands Powder River Coal Basin to our coast to export abroad. And every single one of those proposals has been defeated now, just in the last week. The last ones fell by tribally led environmental opposition that includes some of the fishermen, some of the crabbers, some of the people who have previously been opposing tribal treaty rights in this region. So you see this pattern around the country, and it's been amazingly successful in many of these places.
And you write about a lot of examples at the very, very local level of cooperation between Native groups and white communities. Is that a pattern you just mentioned, is it emerging where they're cooperating between those communities around the country, so a local movement here is learning from a local movement there and visiting a third one over there?
Yeah, definitely. I think that each of the movements makes the next one easier to form. So the success around the Crandon mine, for instance, created a precedent for the people fighting the proposed iron mine in the Pinokies, and Bad River leading that opposition and scoring one of the only victories by a social movement, by an opposition movement against a proposal by Governor Walker. And so, again, we can see the strength of these rural movements that I think have been overestimated or underestimated as just kind of quaint rural local people that don't know much standing up to these giant companies. In fact, they're very much educated. They educate their neighbors. They organize their neighbors. They have potlucks. They have social interaction with each other and really build community in the process and learn about each other's cultures. So after they defeat a proposal or perhaps after they lose, they still have that greater cultural understanding of protecting sacred sites, protecting the wild rice, protecting the resources, and learning from each other. So it creates overall kind of a gradual improvement in relations and more neighborliness.
And as we wrap up, Zoltan, is there a lesson here for any group where there are two communities that, you know, maybe think they understand each other but really don't? How to bridge the gaps and start to break the ice between two groups?
Yeah, I think part of it is to find the people that already have some kind of contact between the groups. We've seen kind of looking to the future where they can cooperate over things like returning land, such as around the Kickapoo Dam or Badger Munitions, or protecting their water from the Perrier proposal or frac sand proposal that the Ho-Chunk Nation led. It's really to look to their common values over the land and what actually unites them, and oftentimes that is water. So that slogan at Standing Rock, water is life, is something that can really extend throughout the country, and that was certainly important in northern Wisconsin and southern Wisconsin.
Zoltan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Zoltan Grossman. He's a professor of geography and native studies at the Evergreen State College. He's the author of the book Unlikely Alliances, Native Nations and White Communities Joined to Defend Rural Lands. A lot of his case studies involve, as you just heard, stories from around Wisconsin.